The United States has tremendous wealth. The wealth is under its feet. I've made that wealth come alive. We are now the number one energy producer in the world, and soon it will be by far.
From Pacifica Radio, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, elsewhere in California on KFOI Red Bluff Redding, KKRN Round Mountain, KGOE in Eureka, in Oregon on KYAQ on the Central Coast, KSO in Cottage Grove, KEPW in Eugene, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, WLRI, and Maui, Hawaii, KAKU. Columbus, Ohio, WGRN. In Palinville, New York, WLPP. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, WPRR. New Orleans, Louisiana, WHIV. In Gallup, New Mexico, KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire, WNHN. Fayetteville, Arkansas, KPSQ. Seattle, Washington, KODX. In Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR. Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950, KTNF. And coast to coast and around the globe, streaming on the internets, on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, Deprogrammed Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing the globe 5 days a week, usually hosted by Brad Friedman of BradBlog.com. But today, you got me again. I'm Nicole Sandler, host of The Nicole Sandler Show at, you guessed it, NicoleSandler.com. Thrilled to be along for a couple of days this week. We got a lot of territory to cover, even though these are the dog days of August and it seems like everyone's on vacation. But make no mistake, there's a lot going on. So we start with a look at what's happening in the news.
I read the news today.
The 2019 G7 meetings in France are now history, and Donald Trump has returned to Washington, D.C. Although the media is spinning it as more successful than last year's G7 meetings, there's a big cleanup in progress on aisle America. First of all, arguably the biggest crisis facing the planet today is climate change. Well, Donald Trump skipped the G7's crucial sessions on climate change, biodiversity, and the devastating fires ravaging the Amazon rainforest. When asked if he had attended, Trump told reporters,
"I'm going to. In fact, it's going to be our next session."
In fact, it had already happened, and that's why the reporter was asking that question. So what was the excuse? According to the White House press secretary, quote, the president had scheduled meetings and bilaterals with Germany and India. So a senior member of the Trump administration attended in his stead. The problem here, both the leaders of Germany and India were at that climate change meeting, as the photos showed very clearly, while the president's chair remained empty.
Trump stepped into another pile of it, noting that the U.S. would host the 2020 G7 summit and suggested that he could host world leaders at his Trump-owned Miami Doral golf resort. Now, of course, critics argue that would be another clear violation of the Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which prohibits presidents from accepting payments from foreign countries, U.S. states, or the federal government. It's bad enough that Trump used the world stage to promote one of his golf properties in what truly sounded like an extended commercial. But then he lied again, saying that he wouldn't make any money on it.
In my opinion, I'm not going to make any money. I don't want to make money. I don't care about making money. If I want to make money, I wouldn't worry about $3 billion to $5
billion. Ah, the mendacity of it all. There he is, the president lying to the American people, claiming that he's losing $3 to $5 billion a year by being president. Right. So Trump was, as usual, full of lies and contradictions on the world stage. He lied about a call from China claiming that they now want to reopen trade talks.
China called last night our top trade people and said, let's get back to the table. So we'll be getting back to the table.
He later exaggerated the claim.
In fact, the president later said there were, quote, many calls, numerous calls, high-level calls. The only problem, China's foreign minister's office says, it is not aware of any calls, and no one else from the Chinese government has come forward to say that they participated.
The Chinese are saying that there weren't any particular...
The Chinese are not saying that. Excuse me, let me explain something. The vice chairman of China, it's like the vice president, the vice chairman made the statement that he wants to make a deal, that he wants to see a calm atmosphere. He wants it all to happen.
So it was a foreign ministry statement, not a phone call directly to the president or his aides. It was actually a statement of China's longstanding position on the issue. So why is the president framing it as something new today in a call that wasn't a call, but just a general public statement?
One of the things that comes from is the back and forth and the changing statements from yourself. So that
It's the way I negotiate.
So my question is that a strategy? Is it a strategy to call President Xi an enemy one day and then say that relations are very good the next day? And then, you know, I mean, it's gone back and forth.
The way I negotiate, it's done very well for me over the years, and it's doing even better for the country.
Trump lied about the reason he skipped the climate summit, but he was busted.
Did you make the climate session, were there any conclusions that you took?
It's going to be our next session.
In fact, it had already happened, and that's why the reporter was asking that question. So what was the excuse? According to the White House press secretary, quote, the president had scheduled meetings and bilaterals with Germany and India. So a senior member of the Trump administration attended in his stead. The problem here, both the leaders of Germany and India were at that climate change meeting, as the photos showed very clearly, while the president's chair remained empty.
But we're not done yet. I guess it's not enough that Trump fell in love with one of the world's most brutal dictators, but then he lied about his wife also having a relationship with Kim Jong-un.
First Lady has gotten to know Kim Jong-un, and I think she'd agree with me. He is a man with a country that has tremendous potential.
Perhaps you don't recall ever seeing the First Lady meet Kim Jong-un. That's because she has not met the North Korean leader. So how does the White House explain that discrepancy? Quote, President Trump confides in his wife on many issues, including the detailed elements of his strong relationship with Chairman Kim. And while the First Lady hasn't met him, the president feels like she's gotten to know him, too.
I can just picture the threesome. Ugh. On Monday, Newsweek reported that an attorney representing Congressman Devin Nunes of California is arguing that two parody Twitter accounts making fun of him are as dangerous as guns. The lawsuit alleges that the parody accounts called Devin Nunes's mom and Devin Nunes's cow constitute, quote, an orchestrated defamation campaign of stunning breadth and scope, one that no human being should ever have to bear and suffer in their whole life. Seriously. And they further argue that for Twitter to keep them operating is equivalent to negligently giving someone a firearm without determining if they're qualified to use it. Ah, just another day in Trump's America. And I have one more story to tell you about. The Democratic National Committee held its summer meetings last weekend in San Francisco. Among other things on the agenda, the idea of a climate debate. After the Resolutions Committee voted it down on Thursday, the subject came up again at the general meeting on Saturday. The final vote was 222 to 137, with the establishment wing of the party prevailing over the progressives and activists. And it turns out that an old colleague of mine was there. In 1997, I was co-hosting the morning show at 91X, an alternative music station in San Diego. One of the other members of the air staff was known as Maddie. We reconnected a few years ago and during the 2016 elections when Maddie was traveling the country canvassing and getting out the vote. Well, Maddie is now known as Matt Keating. He lives in Oregon, where he's an elected member of the Board of Education for Lane Community College and a member of the DNC. As such, he was there this weekend, and I asked him to call in. So here we are today, both progressive political activists concerned, certainly still loving our music and our dogs, but concerned about the future of this country. And so I'm watching, looking at your Facebook page, and I see that you are a member of the DNC and you represent Oregon. And there you were in San Francisco this weekend for the DNC summer meetings. And I got wind of a little bit of trouble in paradise. I think it was Thursday when the Resolutions Committee met and they struck down, and tell me, I'm probably getting terminology wrong, so correct me when I'm wrong, because chances are I'm wrong about some of this. They struck down, the committee did, the idea of a climate-only debate. And then once the committee voted it down, there was still an opportunity for it to be brought up before the entire convention on Saturday, which is then what happened. Do I have that right?
So they're in committee, and mind you, I'm not a member of the resolutions committee, but I, you know, as a member of the DNC, I did observe and participate in that I supported, I want to say at least seven or eight resolutions, several that were actually calling for a multi-candidate debate or forum on critical issues, including, but not limited to, the climate crisis.
Okay.
And the one I was most proud of, resolution number five, that was promoted by the Washington State Democratic Party chair, ultimately didn't go as far as we wanted in committee. The one that was moved forward in committee was resolution number four, and it still revolved around a climate crisis forum, a multi-candidate forum or debate. And that's ultimately, that amended resolution is what came to the floor.
Okay.
Here's the good news, though, Nicole.
Yeah.
Is that though there was a lot of great debate, our delegation from Oregon stood united in the support of this concept of a climate debate or a climate conversation or a climate forum. And so the DNC as a whole, though there was debate about process, I'm convinced, it's reflected in our Saturday general session meeting, that the DNC as a whole, our members are unanimous in recognizing the climate crisis. The problem is that there are many crises that the GOP and Donald Trump in particular are exacerbating. And it's the Democratic Party that's working to try and fix it.
Of
and
course.
In particular, Oregon's delegation and the delegation representing the Western Caucus are actively trying to find a way, an active abatement to the critical climate crisis.
Right. And that needs to be done. Now, in terms of debates, I guess that it was a lot of semantics in terms of what's a debate and what's a forum, because actually, I believe next week or sometime this month, MSNBC has a climate forum, I think in the next week or two, and then CNN is going to have one as well. But the way the DNC rules are written, the candidates can't be on the stage at the same time and they can't address one another. So it's like these other parades that have gone on at different events around the country where it's a one after another, and each candidate gets like 5 minutes to talk. And, you know, I'm sorry. I want to hear them talk with each other. I want to hear ideas being thrown around. I want to hear a debate, and they're saying no, that's not going to happen.
And here's the good news, though. It, you know, maybe there's an opportunity for a more substantive conversation, a more fleshed out thought process that may be a little more genuine than the kind of soundbite attack each other approach. You know, even the debates can devolve, as you know, and thankfully our Democratic candidates are not swiping at each other and you know, have the eye on the ball and the eye on the prize, and that's to take back the White House and take back the United States Senate, take back the House in 2020. I advocated strongly for a multi-candidate climate crisis debate, as did the rest of our delegation here in the Beaver State. But here's the silver lining. A, possibly a more substantive conversation through this forum process, the two of which you alluded to on MSNBC and CNN in September. And B, the whole conversation has now been amplified in a way that it may not have been had we just moved forward with those resolutions. You know, folks were passionate on both sides of the conversation. But again, I recognize that it's the Democratic Party, certainly not the Republican Party or Trump's Republican Party as it stands, who are even tackling the summit. The man doesn't even show up. He is an empty chair at this point when it comes to discussing climate on a global level and the crises that we're facing, this existential threat to our planet, to all life that inhabits this beautiful planet. So, you know, look, has the conversation been amplified and elevated in a way that it's never been? Yes. It's your 21, 22, or 23, all of the Democratic candidates, certainly all the ones that I saw this weekend, are all on board for a greater climate conversation.
Right.
So between that and our epic sunrise youth movement, mm-hmm. who are highlighting the issue with passion and vigor
amazing.
And energy. Pardon me?
They're amazing, these kids.
They're so good. They were so inspiring. Nicole, after that resolutions meeting that we talked about at the top mm-hmm. of this conversation, our chair, Casey Hansen, and I went out to the hall and thanked every one of them
that we
could, because they're our future, and they're fighting for an inhabitable, it's wild is that we have to say this, we're fighting for an inhabitable planet, fighting for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
You know, I don't want to talk about process. I want to talk about solutions.
Right.
And Donald Trump has babies taking care of babies in the most deplorable and disgusting conditions on our southern border. We have climate refugees all over the planet. Sea levels are rising. The ice caps are melting. No one, the so-called president of these United States is rolling back Obama era protections.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the coal industry, whether it's a lack of, or whether it's just gutting the EPA. Or allowing for trophy hunters, allowing for big donors to get passes to go and trophy hunt.
Killing the Endangered Species Act. Killing the Endangered Species Act. I mean, really, when you think everything, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, at age 8 years old, I used to get zoo books and I would cry reading about these endangered animals. And now we've been killing off 65% of the world's population in the last 40 years. There's something fundamentally wrong. If the president of these United States can't recognize it, it's just one of 8 million reasons why he should be repealed and replaced. And I'm voting not just blue, no matter who, I'm voting blue against you know who.
Yes, well, so am I. I'm voting blue against you know who, as I did last time. And you know, I was not a Hillary Clinton fan. You know, but the vote blue, no matter who, I've got a problem with that. Wait till the general for that. We're still in a primary where I think it's our responsibility to vote for the best possible candidate. And I think this year we're really lucky. We've got riches here. I've got you can't see me, but I'm holding up my Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders action figures that keep me company here in the studio while I'm on the air. So
I have a Warren action figure at my studio right
awesome.
Here as well.
There you go.
You know, I was in Iowa so we actually connected. Both of us were Democracy for America fellows back in
2010. I was.
2010.
Yeah.
We're dating ourselves.
Yeah.
And so I found myself working with MoveOn.org and was in Iowa in early 2015 to try and draft Warren as part of the Run Warren Run movement.
Yep.
And so, she was my first choice in 2015 after meeting all those candidates. Bernie was my second choice. Mm-hmm. And I put my life on hold for a year, of course, and as you alluded to, traveled the country, registered voters, hired folks
you
up,
did.
And then ultimately, Secretary Clinton was the only choice to beat Donald Trump. We can't let folks sit on the sidelines this year.
Well, exactly.
With a crop of great candidates we have, I'm confident that through our primary processes and our caucus processes, that the best candidate will rise to the occasion, and that team, that future president and vice president of these United States will have to right a ship because our democracy and our republic, our reputation and the stake and livability of the entire planet are at stakes. We say it every election, Nicole, this is the most important election of our lifetime and future generations.
Without a doubt. Hey, Matt, I got one more question for you. You know, obviously, we're on my show now. We're live on the Nicole Sandler Show. But this week, I'm also guest hosting the Bradcast with Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And Desi does the Green News Report. And she's got a question for you. She said, can they explain what I imagine is a balancing act for the DNC? How to educate the public about climate change solutions and appease the youth voters they need without triggering Republicans and endangering campaign donations, which they'll need to combat the fossil fuel industry's tsunami of dark money. How's that for a question?
That's a heck of a question.
Yeah.
We got to talk about this climate crisis as to how it affects our livability, how it affects the economy, how it affects our daily lives, and how it affects our not just our coastal communities, but how it affects our relationship right in the heartland of our nation, our farmers' relationship with the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. Here we are in the hottest summer on record.
Yeah.
The Amazon is on fire. Today's the hottest in the city I live in, Eugene, Oregon. Today's the hottest day of the year.
Yeah, I believe it. I can't even walk outside here. And we have a hurricane headed our way, just in case anyone was wondering. It's now Tropical Storm Dorian. And here, hold on. For those of you watching on YouTube, again, I'll put up a graphic that's truly frightening, because the cone of uncertainty shows it going kind of right over Puerto Rico again. And like a direct hit on South Florida, almost right where I am, 8 a.m. Sunday morning, just in case you were wondering.
Oh.
Yeah. So we have that to look forward to.
Well, it's only the Democrats on this campaign trail, and only the 46th president of these United States with a D behind his or her name, mm-hmm. are willing to address the crisis. And,
yep.
and as that Amazon burns, and as we try and rectify this horrific, horrible mess that Donald Trump seems to continue to exacerbate and or ignore, it's only the Democrats who are willing to invest in renewable energy jobs and exceed those fossil fuel jobs, even right here in Oregon. It's a national growing trend. Investing in wind, wave, solar are critical, and it's only the Democratic Party that's going to help get us there. So
yeah,
I am fired up after this weekend. I know that the some of our votes we took didn't quite go our well, but man, we have amplified the need to find an abatement to climate change now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thrilled that all of our Democratic candidates are taking this seriously and going to address this critical climate crisis.
Absolutely.
On the campaign
trail. Let me just say one last thing, though. I'm really disappointed is too calm a word in the DNC. I put out my most retweeted tweet this weekend, and I was actually tweet quoted in Newsweek, and it's amazing. Nina Turner retweeted me, and Sean King retweeted me, and I'm looking for the original tweet to see if I can find it. What I said, here's what I wrote. I was retweeting something, a BBC News article. The headline reads, "Amazon fires, Bolsonaro says Brazil cannot fight them." And I wrote, "The planet is literally burning, and the DNC won't allow a climate debate." I listened to that thing on Saturday, sitting here at my computer, my head shaking the entire time as Tom Perez was droning on and on. I was so disgusted with it. And my view, I'm glad, Matt, you're a good party guy, and we need people like that. I hate the way this party is run, let me put it that way. I think Tom Perez is horrible. I think they don't listen to the people. I think they're running the risk of alienating the young progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is now the energized wing of the party. And if they push Joe Biden over Bernie or Elizabeth, there's going to be a big problem. And so I just hope, you know, minds like yours at the DNC can have some influence on Tom Perez and the other establishment people who I'm so scared are poised to do the same thing as they did last time. They fixed the election last time in favor of Hillary Clinton instead of letting it play out naturally. I'm not saying Bernie would have necessarily won the primary, but they should have kept their fingers out of the till. I think the DNC's role is to stay neutral in a primary. They don't feel that way. And I'm really concerned that they're going to try to push us towards a, quote, centrist, or what they call a moderate, which is what I call a conservadem, and it will alienate all the young people who are the ones who are activated right now.
Well, some of the reforms we've fought for in my time on the DNC since 2017, including superdelegate reform, allows for voters in primary and caucus states to determine who our nominee is going to be. And unpledged automatic delegates, aka superdelegates,
yeah,
will only participate in the second round.
Yeah,
and as a newly elected DNC member, I'm one of those superdelegates who advocated to roll back my undemocratic automatic
authority.
They
shouldn't be there
that
at all.
Came from the bottom
Matt,
up.
Yeah, but Matt, they shouldn't. I'm sorry. They shouldn't be there at all. We're looking. But my prediction is we're going to have a brokered convention, because right now it looks like you got Biden, Bernie, and Elizabeth Warren. the three of them at the top. I honestly don't think anyone's going to...
I wouldn't rule out... I hear you in regards to the polling that we're hearing in the traditional media, but I wouldn't rule out some other great candidates. We have 23 candidates, and a lot more than just three of them are firing folks up. That's what I'm seeing. That energy is going to activate the grassroots base. And it's the grassroots base. It's the people-powered. It's the youth movement. It's that sunrise movement. That's going to lead the direction of not just the Democratic Party, but ultimately our Democratic nominee.
Well, I agree.
The Democratic Party may be perceived at this juncture as top-down, but fundamentally, we elected and re-elected Barack Obama from the bottom up.
Right.
It is a grassroots, people-powered
movement. Yeah, but they appointed Tom Perez.
A Democrat.
They appointed Hillary Clinton. Matt, I love you, and I'm glad you play the party game so well. I could never do it. I'd be fighting with everyone there. My cautionary tale here is to the DNC to tell them to keep their distance. Let the people decide. They need to take their thumbs off the scale and let the people decide. Anyway, Matt Keating, hopefully we'll keep this dialogue going throughout the election. I love hearing all that you're up to, and I love that you're so involved. And thank you for coming on today.
Well, thank you. And I miss you, my friend. Thank you for doing what you do.
I miss you, too. Take care, and thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's my old friend, Matt Keating. You can check him out online at mattkeating.org. Still to come on today's edition of the Bradcast, a conversation with one of the 2020 Democratic hopefuls who's still in the game. Yep, he's been cleared to participate in the next debate next month in Houston. That'll air on ABC. That's coming up next. I'm Nicole Sandler, guest hosting this edition of the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler, in today for Brad and Desi. And the next of the Democratic 2020 primary debates is scheduled for September 12th and 13th in Houston. It'll air on ABC. We're getting down to the wire for qualifying, as the lineup will be finalized at the end of the day on Wednesday. Most of the candidates are still fighting to meet the criteria. They've got to garner more than 2% in four of the DNC-approved polls. And they must also receive donations from at least 130,000 unique donors over the course of the election cycle, with a minimum of 400 unique donors per state in at least 20 states. Got that? Qualifying donations must be received by 11:59 p.m. on August 28th for the September debate. As of Tuesday at noon, 10 candidates have made the cut. Both Tom Steyer's and Tulsi Gabbard's campaigns claim that they have met the donor benchmark, but the polling is a more difficult obstacle to overcome. In alphabetical order, the candidates who have thus far qualified for the next debate are Joe Biden, Cory Booker, Pete Buttigieg, Julian Castro, Kamala Harris, Amy Klobuchar, Beto O'Rourke, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Andrew Yang. Now, when I first heard about Andrew Yang, it was from a listener of my show, and I was intrigued. Then Andrew Yang inserted himself into a Twitter conversation I was having, and I invited him on the show. That was in January, and Andrew Yang has surprised most everyone. I thought today would be a good time to share our conversation so you can hear, in more than 60-second sound bites, what Andrew Yang is all about. So, with no further ado, we head back to January 25th, 2019, to speak with presidential candidate Andrew Yang. I'm Nicole Sandler, in for Brad and Desi, on the Bradcast. I began by asking him about his background, how he earned his fortune, and arrived at this place where he's running for president. I guess your background as an entrepreneur afforded you some success, and you use that then for the greater good. Tell us a bit about how you earned your fortune and then what you've done with it, what VFA is.
Sure. So I was the CEO of an education company that grew to become number one in the United States and was acquired by a public company, the Washington Post, in 2009. Mm-hmm. And everyone listening to this remembers 2009, the country was still going through the depths of the financial crisis. And it made me sad and dispirited, just like it made everyone else sad. And I thought, well, how did this happen? And what I thought was the cause at the time was we had so much energy and talent heading to Wall Street and Silicon Valley and not to Detroit or New Orleans or Birmingham or St. Louis or Cleveland to help build the next generation of American company. And so I quit my job. I donated $120,000 to a seed nonprofit called Venture for America that recruits and trains aspiring entrepreneurs to work at businesses and then start businesses in Detroit, Cleveland, Baltimore, St. Louis. So the organization grew and grew to a point where it helped create several thousand jobs. I was honored by the Obama White House. And I'm happy to say even now that I'm running for president, the organization continues to thrive without me. The new CEO is a woman named Amy Nelson, who is my number two. And it gave me a lot of joy to be able to leave the organization in such capable hands. So that's what I've been doing for the last 7 years, helping create jobs in the Midwest and the South. And I realized during my time in these regions that the reason why Donald Trump is our president today is that we automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Missouri, Wisconsin. Even as I was working to create tens, hundreds of jobs in these regions, I saw that the automation of these manufacturing jobs has been devastating to many, many American communities.
And they have, and I agree. But do you think that there's any way back? I mean, you look at Trump, who's promising to, you know, repopulate the coal mines. We all know that that's not realistic. That's not the way of the future. That what should be done with the coal miners is to retrain them. Maybe, retrain them in infrastructure or something else where their talents can be utilized. But we know that there's not going to be a return to coal mining despite all of Trump's bluster. Do you think manufacturing by humans is coming back?
No, I don't. But I want to point out something really difficult for progressives and Democrats to acknowledge.
Okay.
Is that we blasted away 4 million jobs in these regions. And I've been in these towns and communities, and they are hurting. Mm-hmm. Like, hurting to a point where now suicides and drug overdoses have spiked to unprecedented levels.
Mm-hmm.
And so Donald Trump shows up and says, we're going to turn back time, we're going to bring your jobs back, we're going to build a wall, all the stuff that is nonsense, frankly.
Yes.
And even on some level, many of the people who voted for him know that none of those things are happening. But the Democratic response was essentially to ignore the central problem, was to pretend that that getting rid of 4 million manufacturing jobs actually shouldn't hurt anyone, and that these people can just transition to new jobs. When the reality is, and even when you are struggling with what you would do with tens of thousands of former coal miners,
mm-hmm.
retraining is an effective solution for approximately 5 to 15% of displaced workers, according to the stats. And that's from government-funded retraining programs, when people are lucky enough to even have those programs to access.
Agreed.
So we're talking about 80 to 85% of workers who lose their jobs in these contexts will not be retrained for a new job. And that is why Donald Trump's our president today. We have to start owning the truth of the problems that got him elected.
Okay, so what is the answer? What do we do about all these lost manufacturing jobs? And by the way, I just got to say, I had interviewed Bernie Sanders for years, long before he ever, you know, jumped into the presidential fray. And, one of the topics he was always talking about was the travesty of all the lost manufacturing jobs in our country. So it's not all Democrats who just said, it's the sign of the times.
Yeah, but it's true. Bernie's on top of it. You're 100%
yes,
right.
Okay, cool.
So the big issue, though, to me is that the conventional progressive prescription has been what you just described, which is education and retraining.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds very, very reasonable. But when you start looking at the actual reality on the ground, you see that, for example, the average truck driver is a 49-year-old male with a high school education and health problems, because mm-hmm. sitting in a truck is very bad for your health.
Sure.
And so even if you were to give that person, like, you know, some government-funded certificate in some business skills, most companies would much rather hire someone younger, cheaper.
And, tell me about it.
I know that less experienced. Yes. And then the former truck driver mm-hmm. might not want that job anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a massive misalignment with the needs of the labor market and the needs of some of these displaced workers. So the reason why we're all struggling with this set of problems, Nicole, is that the solutions are much, much bigger than most of us are comfortable talking about. And so to me, and you've seen this with my platform, I'm suggesting that we replace this current atmosphere of scarcity that Americans are laboring under, essentially a subsistence labor arrangement that most of us have, mm-hmm. and move towards a broader definition of citizenship and work and value, and start declaring a dividend for all American adults of $1,000 a month, $12,000 a year.
Universal basic income.
Universal basic
income. And we've talked about that on this program before, and I'm a proponent of it. I think it's a great idea. But you also know that $1,000 a month isn't going to do much to replace an income.
Yeah, it's not. And one of the misconceptions about it is that it's somehow a work replacement. Mm-hmm. In most instances, it's not a work replacement. But what it does do is it helps shield us from existential crises that happen. And we can see it when these federal workers, thank goodness the government looks like it's reopening.
Yeah, great deal.
When these federal workers miss one paycheck, then they fall off an edge.
Yeah.
And when workers lose their jobs, like they plummet into financial ruin. And so with $1,000 a month, it's not a silver bullet, but it does end up easing many of these transitions. Because if you look at the numbers, right now Americans are moving across state lines, starting businesses, getting married and having children all at record lows. Hmm. And $1,000 a month could help make our families and communities much, much stronger and healthier. It also helps to reward and compensate women for the work that's being done in communities around the country that is right now being unrewarded and unrecognized, which unfortunately women do the vast majority of.
Yeah, I hear you. And so universal basic income would be a sort of a buffer, basically, against disaster, which so many Americans are experiencing now after missing just two paychecks. It still doesn't answer the question of how we get these people back to work. But this is just one of many issues. And in fact, if people visit yang2020.com, there's a page on Andrew's policies. And you've got the three big ones, universal basic income, Medicare for all, and human-centered capitalism, which is fascinating. But then you've got you have on the issues and the page you keep scrolling and scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And I got to tell you, this is refreshing because so many candidates, whether it's for, you know, your local congressional seat or for president, they don't put out all their positions because I think they get away with more by being a bit cagey. You're putting it all out there. You're in fact, you have a quote on the website from the Democratic Party leadership in Iowa. It says, Mr. Yang is the most detailed and comprehensive set of policy proposals we have ever seen at this stage in the campaign. So you've obviously been working on this for a while. How long have you been a declared candidate?
Well, I declared in the New York Times February of last year.
So you were the first in, weren't you?
I think John Delaney preceded me, though people tend to forget about John. But I'm heading to Iowa for the eighth time next week, and I've now just started to poll there, where I was tied with Kirsten Gillibrand in the last poll. So when you ask, how can we make this vision a reality, how can I win, it really centers upon, as you know, the voters in Iowa and New Hampshire and whether they will embrace a new economic vision that helps put people first.
Which I got to say,
Iowa
and New Hampshire, I mean, just that alone, our whole electoral process, is it right to put the fate of the nation in the hands of Iowa and New Hampshire?
Well, you know, I'm an operator, and so you don't, you know, you don't wish for the lay of the land.
Right. I got you. You deal with what you got.
Yep. So, as you know, our current system advantages those two states a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, you're doing the work that needs to be done. I notice that your name is included on some of the graphics put up by the TV stations or the articles written about the candidates who are in the race. Sometimes you're there and sometimes you're not. How much of a challenge is it getting your not only your ideas out there, but being taken seriously as a candidate?
Well, you know, it's one reason, again, I'm grateful to have a conversation with you in this context, because You know, in your case, a listener told you about me, and you may or may not have heard of me at that point. But when people talk to me or meet me, I found that they find that I have a very clear vision for where we have to go, and I'm speaking very honestly about the problems that have gotten us to this point. Because technology is advancing in a way that's displacing more and more American workers. 30% of American malls are going to close in the next 4 years because Amazon is just sucking up so much business. And working in retail is still the most common job in our communities around the country. The average retail worker is a 39-year-old woman with a high school degree making between $11 and $12 an hour. So we have to start owning the magnitude of these changes. We are in the third inning of the greatest economic and technological transformation in the history of the world. And Donald Trump is a symptom. He's a manifestation of the fact that we're in the third inning, and we need to get our heads up and wake Americans up to the fact that we're going to need much bigger, more impactful solutions to get through this time.
Well, most definitely. I'm still stuck on this. And you talk a lot about automation. You put much of the blame of the mess we find ourselves in now on automation. I'm a victim of it. I'm a radio career person. I started in radio in college back in 1979. So I'm in my 40th year of radio. I've been downsized and replaced by automation. Radio did it years ago with an Orwellian named program called Profit, but it was spelled P-R-O-P-H-E-T. But it was designed to make radio stations a profit, whereby one person could sit in a studio in City X and spend all day voice tracking air shifts for radio stations around the country. You hit a button and it goes, eliminating thousands of jobs. So the radio industry, from the time I got into it until today, has shrunk, you know, a hundredfold. I mean, there's what job used to be done by one person. Now you've got that one person doing 10 to 15 jobs, and I'm not exaggerating. Yes. And that's playing out across the country. You talk about automation, putting all these people out of jobs, closing factories. Again, what is the new economy that will get us working again?
Yeah, so this is the great thing about the Freedom Dividend, which is how I rebranded Universal Basic Income.
Okay.
So if you imagine a town of 50,000 adults in Missouri or Florida, and let's say the work is starting to dry up, but all of a sudden, Andrew Yang is the president in 2021, we pass the Freedom Dividend, which, by the way, a plan just like this is in effect in Alaska already, so we have 37 years of data showing that it works.
Okay.
And so everyone in this town of 50,000 gets another $1,000 a month. That's $50 million a month, $600 million a year, now in the hands of the people in this town. Now, what are they going to spend the money on? They're going to spend it on exactly what we all spend money on, which is tutoring and services for our kids, food, car repairs, the occasional night out,
housing,
home repairs, health care. And the vast majority of that money is going to go right back into the local economy. And so what's going to happen is that those businesses are going to hire right there locally. They're not going to hire, you know, like fancy engineers. They're just going to hire the people that are there to staff the additional shifts at the garage and the restaurant. And that's how we can create a robust economy here, is just by putting buying power into the hands of ourselves, the owners and citizens of this country. If you were to implement the Freedom Dividend, it would grow our consumer economy by 8% and create 2 million jobs immediately, because that's just what would happen if we were to increase our own buying power in an economy the size of our current economy, which is up to $20 trillion. We can easily afford a dividend for our citizens, and it has the byproduct of creating millions of jobs.
I agree with you on that. I also agree with you on Medicare for All, which is another one of your major platforms. You know, I'll play devil's advocate here. I know how we pay for it. I think we save money by going to Medicare for All, because we have the most expensive health care system in the world with the worst results. So we're in agreement there. Let me ask you about a friend of the show, Stephanie Kelton, who's an advocate of modern monetary theory. Are you of that mind? Yes. And what about the Green New Deal? Are you in that?
Also aligned in favor. You know, it's like it's clear that we need to move towards renewable sources of energy. I'm aligned with just about every progressive priority. And one of the reasons why people find me interesting is that when I talk to CEOs and business people, they find me very reasonable too. Because if I say to them, look, your businesses do better when consumers have money to spend.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a very interesting messenger for policies that you and Stephanie and your listeners, I think, are aligned with, because I see the same things you see, Nicole.
Great. Again, I'm looking at the issues that you write about on the website. The freedom dividend, combat climate change, reduce mass incarceration, the opioid crisis, LGBTQ rights. Then you get to foreign policy first principles. Now, there's not a whole lot in here about foreign policy. And I've got to say, in the universe of all the issues that you're dealing with, I'm guessing that foreign policy might be where you have the least expertise. Nobody's could be as bad as Donald Trump's, but what makes you presidential when it comes to foreign policy?
You know, I think most Americans realize that we've made some tragic mistakes over the last number of years. And what we need most in a commander-in-chief is sound judgment and a sense of restraint. I mean, the fact is that if we are falling apart at home, which we are, we're not going to be able to project our values and achieve our goals internationally. Certainly not without very strong relationships and allies. So those would be my first principles as commander-in-chief, are judgment and restraint. And I will present myself as someone who has a problem-solving mindset and orientation, and if the American people see that my judgment can be trusted on domestic issues, I believe they'll see that I'll have the right people in place to deal with foreign policy.
And I believe that you are fully capable of hiring the right people. I just, you know, I think back to the guy there now who's, I'll hire the best people, and we see what we came up with. It's why we need somebody who's educated, who is the real deal, and actually has made a fortune on his own and uses it for good purposes and like that. So,
It's funny you say that, Nicole, is that some Trump voters say they're going to vote for me because they say, you are what Trump pretended to be. And on the progressive side, my applause line is the opposite of Donald Trump is an Asian man who likes math.
That's a good one. I like that. That would make a good bumper sticker as well. So in terms of the campaign, again, Andrew Yang is with us. You can find him on Twitter. That's how I met him. And he inserted himself into a conversation and agreed to come on the show. And I so appreciate it. At Andrew Yang VFA. And the website, again, yang2020.com, which is filled with statements on different policies, again, which this should be the rule. This should be how every campaign website looks.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And it isn't. So that's why, I mean, you can have hours and hours of reading here to find out where you stand on all these issues. And I think a lot of candidates don't like to put it on in writing because they want to be, you know, malleable. They want you to be able to project what you want onto this candidate. And you're saying, well, here's who I am. Here's what I believe. Here's what I can do. And that's admirable. Are you ready for the ugliness? I mean, I know you're running as a Democrat, yes?
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, as I've already mentioned, in the last election, I was a big Bernie Sanders supporter. I did vote for Hillary Clinton when it came down to it because, you know, anyone but Trump. Unfortunately, we know what happened. But my heart is with Bernie's ideas and his policies. As I said, I'd been interviewing him for years before he ever decided to run for president. We need this stuff and we need it out there on the debate stage. So this is what you're doing full time. You are running for president. You're all in.
Yeah, of course. You know, raised hundreds of thousands of dollars from tens of thousands of donors around the country. Average donation is only $19. So we joke that my fans are even cheaper than Bernie.
Okay.
But you were ahead of the curve. I was also a Bernie supporter and then voted for Hillary Clinton. I agree that we need to solve the problems that Bernie brought to the forefront. I would suggest that there may be some ways to address some of these problems that are a bit more modern and impactful. But I 100% am aligned with the goals that Bernie held. We need to do much, much more to improve the lives of the American people.
Have you heard anything from or had any discussions with the DNC?
Yeah, I'm friendly with several members of the DNC, and I was an appointee under President Obama. I was an ambassador of entrepreneurship. So I'm friendly with many senior Democrats, and, you know, many of them are excited to have me in the race. Some believe I'm going to express ideas that need to be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also the first Asian-American man to run for president as a Democrat, and there are some people in the DNC that are excited about that.
Great. No, I am too. I'm just wondering, you know, I would hope that after 2016, they're going to be more welcoming with open arms of all comers, of anyone who wants to throw their hat in the ring. I think that's what primaries are for. It's when we hear the ideas, and it's the time when people like you are so important, because we can hear what's possible. The old adage, people fall in love during the primary and they fall in line during the general. I think never has that been more important. And I haven't always ascribed to that, the falling in line thing. I tend to, march to the beat of my own drummer. But the right now, with so much at stake, I think it is very important. So we've got debates coming up and fundraising, and you got a head start on most of them. Have you heard from any of the other candidates?
You know, it's one of the really fun things about this process, Nicole, is that I've now met a number of the other candidates in Iowa and New Hampshire on the trail, because, that's where we all are hanging out.
Sure.
And that's been a real joy for me. And I'm happy to say that most of the other candidates are true patriots and leaders who just want to do right by the country. And I appreciate how ahead of the curve you've been in identifying some of these needs. And seeing that Bernie's voice was one that needed to be front and center. But I've enjoyed getting to know the other candidates. I have a vision that there are going to be a group of us that head to Washington, D.C. to try and solve some of these problems that got Donald Trump elected. And my goal is to be in that group. I'm frankly not that concerned about the seating chart. I just want to solve problems. I'm a parent. I've got two young kids. And I want to leave them a country that we're still proud of.
Oh, yeah. From your words to the universe's ears. Andrew Yang, thank you again for coming on, for letting us get to know you in at least a small way, much ground as we can cover in about 30 minutes. Again, I encourage people to head over to yang2020.com, because there's a plethora of reading materials there, and you might learn something. And if nothing else, maybe it'll spark some questions and we can open the conversation.
Thanks, Nicole.
Take care.
Have a great one.
Bye-bye. You too. Andrew Yang, an impressive guy to be sure. He'll be on the debate stage in 2 weeks from Houston, Texas. Well, the Amazon is burning, and Donald Trump skipped the session on climate change this weekend at the G7, claiming he's the best environmentalist in the world or some such nonsense. Stay right there, because coming up next, Desi Doyen and the Green News Report. I'm Nicole Sandler, your guest host today on the Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler of NicoleSandler.com, holding down the fort for Brad and Desi this week. Thankfully, they left us a fresh edition of the Green News Report, and it couldn't come at a better time. We already heard on today's program from my old friend Matt Keating what went on at the DNC summer meetings, in which the DNC establishment decided they don't need no stinking climate change debate. A lot of the young people beg to differ. I think we're at an impasse. What else is happening in the world of climate and the planet? For that, we turn to Desi Doyen. Take it away, Des.
Hectare after hectare of pristine forest just going up in smoke.
International pressure and protests grow over record fires in Brazil's Amazon rainforest. Democratic National Committee shoots down climate-focused presidential debate. Keystone XL pipeline clears another hurdle in Nebraska. Plus,
President Trump denies a report that he wanted to stop hurricanes with nuclear weapons.
The President of the United States floated nuking hurricanes.
But he says he didn't?
Yeah.
Then he definitely did. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
David Koch of the zillionaire Koch brothers died. He was 79, but his family says they wish it could be longer, but at least he lived long enough to see the Amazon catch fire.
This is your Green News Report.
Mourners are being asked, in lieu of flowers, to just leave their car engine running.
Okay, Desi Doyen, this crisis in the Amazon rainforest is getting worse and worse by the day, by the hour. But before we get there, first big storm of the hurricane season?
Well, it could be. As we go to air, Tropical Storm Dorian has formed in the Atlantic, and residents of Puerto Rico, who are still trying to recover 2 years after Hurricane Maria, are stocking up on supplies, while the President of the United States has reportedly floated the idea of nuking hurricanes. Axios reports that Donald Trump repeatedly asked senior national security officials about bombing hurricanes with nuclear weapons to stop them from hitting the United States. Now, first, that will not work.
Okay.
And second, yes, it would spread radioactive fallout to land areas around the world.
Yeah, but if that land area is Puerto Rico, that may not be a problem for Donald Trump.
Good point. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, even has set up an explanatory website that says, quote, needless to say, this is not a good idea.
Well, apparently, there is a reason that they need to say it.
Meanwhile, in Brazil, large protests have erupted in large cities across Brazil and outside Brazilian embassies around the world, with demonstrators demanding Brazil's right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, do more to fight the record number of fires now decimating the Brazilian Amazon, the world's largest tropical rainforest. Most of the fires are being set by illegal loggers, farmers, and ranchers clearing land in response to Bolsonaro's policies to open up the Amazon for development. International outcry has succeeded in pressuring Bolsonaro to deploy military troops and 2 firefighting aircraft. At the same time, at the weekend meeting in France of the G7, the world's 7 largest economies, G7 leaders agreed to donate $22 million to fight the record fires, which was dismissed by critics as paltry. Leonardo DiCaprio's foundation has also pledged $5 million. The G7 leaders also agreed to assist in funding a medium-term reforestation plan. French President Emmanuel Macron warned that destruction of the Amazon is a global issue because it absorbs a chunk of humanity's carbon emissions, but also because of its influential role in driving global rainfall patterns. Brazil's Bolsonaro criticized that assistance as an attack on his country's sovereignty.
So let me get this straight. The 7 richest countries in the world could only come up with about $22 million, and Leo DiCaprio came up with $5 million all by himself?
Yes.
That is pathetic, isn't it?
And on a side note, at the G7 summit, President Trump skipped the meetings on climate change, biodiversity, and oceans.
Yeah, said he was busy with a meeting that ran long with Germany and India, and yet somehow the leaders of Germany and India were able to make that climate change meeting. Go figure.
In Nebraska, a major victory for the company behind the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, the Nebraska State Supreme Court has given the go-ahead to an alternate route for the Keystone XL. Environmental activists, Native American tribes, and local landowners have sued to stop its construction due to the threat of an oil spill contaminating their lands and water supplies.
I can't believe we are still fighting about the Keystone XL pipeline.
Well, TC Energy, the new name for the old pipeline owner, TransCanada, has not yet announced whether it will still move forward with that project. Bold Nebraska, a group opposing the pipeline, is asking 2020 Democratic presidential candidates to sign a pledge that they will shut it down if elected. Finally, the Democratic National Committee has voted down an initiative to hold a presidential debate singularly focused on climate change. That's a victory for party leadership and a defeat for environmental activists demanding that the party do more to inform the public on candidates' comprehensive proposals to solve the climate crisis.
And a defeat for the world.
However, the DNC did approve a measure that will allow candidates to participate in non-DNC-sponsored climate debates. So for this generational challenge that will involve mobilizing the entire United States, 2 climate forums are scheduled for September 4 on CNN and September 20 on MSNBC.
So there's that. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
But it's all about taking the easy way out. I suppose there's no escape.
And with that, we come to the end of another edition of The Bradcast. I'm Nicole Sandler of NicoleSandler.com. Thank you for hanging with me. We'll do it again tomorrow. Until next time, good luck, world.